When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome everyone to episode number 15 of Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden, a 50-year retrospective, the early years of the WWWF, the WWF, and the WWE. Madison Square Garden, the mecca of professional wrestling, a building that every wrestler wanted to wrestle in. We record one show a month to coincide with the 50th anniversary of a wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden. And to help us look back, as always, at all these shows, a man that went to every wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden for 5 years straight, starting on August 30th, 1971, Mr. Wrestling himself, John Arizzi. John, how you doing?
Happy holidays to you, Tim.
Happy holidays to you, John. I hope you're enjoying the holidays down there in Tennessee. I know you're going to be making a move up to New York very soon, and I hope that's a safe move. But how are your holidays going in Tennessee so far?
Well, I'm not moving. I'm just going to visit family.
Well, you know what I mean. Yeah, you always go for the holiday time. But you now, I don't know where you live in Tennessee, but you always go to this small town and you take great pictures. What town is that?
Franklin, Tennessee. That's the little downtown area, and I was there for the Dickens of a Christmas, 37th annual that they do. And so the town square is literally just three blocks long with kind of a centerpiece, which is an old Confederate soldier on a long, you know, pole, whatever it is, display. That's where the Christmas tree is, and it's a wonderful little town, a very historic town. It was incorporated in 1799. It was probably one of the biggest battles of the Civil War, the Battle of Franklin, where 15,000 Confederate and Union soldiers were killed over the course of 48 hours. So it is a very historic town, a very little quaint town. It hasn't changed much since I moved here 22 years ago. And I just love it. I love the fact that you could go down to the annual Christmas celebration that they do, and they all dress like it was Charles Dickens. I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience. The town does it annually, but they also do, you know, the Pumpkin Festival. There's Bluegrass Festival. So they close down the downtown area, and thousands of people come from all over, not just Franklin, to participate. And it's a lot of fun. And I always have my camera out, and I walk around, and there's all the little vendors and just packed with people, and then the food carts, and it's just an amazing little place. And it's actually in the top 10 of best places to live in the United States.
Wow.
So it's a wonderful, wonderful town. And I live about 4 miles from the downtown area. I live in an area called Cool Springs, which is more metropolitan, I guess you say. You know. So anyway, I love it here, and I know that during the holiday season, everybody gets that Christmas feeling somewhat. As the older you get, it kind of dissipates because it's really about the kids.
Yep.
And that's what you've kind of done yourself. I mean, I don't know how many people who are listening to this podcast really realize what you do when it is this time of year, but you are one of the most popular Santa Clauses on the West Coast. I mean, you were just telling me that you're the official Santa Claus for the Rams Christmas party this weekend.
Yes, it'll right? be over by the time this airs. Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, this will come out, you know, a little after December 18th when the Garden Show was from 72, 50 years later. But you've been really, really busy, and you look the part now. I mean, you look like Santa. You've been doing this for how many years now?
This is my third year doing Santa. The first year was during the pandemic. Second year, I started doing personal appearances. The first year was all on Zoom, because this is what I learned from working with you, doing the Zooms. And then last year, I did more personal appearances. This year, I really buckled down, and I started advertising earlier. So November was my time for photos. So I met with a lot of photographers.
I did like Cooking with Santa and traditional Santa shots, and now we're into the season. And, you know, being, you know, part of professional wrestling, being part of radio, being part of these things, I get to walk around and be a ham. I get to, you know, be a ham. Yeah. And that's what, you know, I've always been a ham, but now people pay me for being a ham. So I really worked on my suit and my look and things like that. And I've been really fortunate. You know, I've been working very hard at, you know, doing a good job and, that, you know, picking up little things. I belong to the Worldwide Santa Network, and I've learned a lot from these gentlemen about, you know, things they say and things you do and how to take care of this, a crying kid or maybe a child with autism or something like that. So I've been really working hard at it, and it's really starting to benefit and seeing the joy. You know, it is about the kids, John. We talked about that before. It's about the kids, and everyone says, well, you have a kid until like 10 years old. That's not true. Probably not. They start liking Santa maybe three, if you're lucky, okay? Maybe two or three. The first couple of years, they're scared of us. Majority are. But then,
I walk at the mall because it's a little cold to walk downtown, and Santa is there. And the kids, the young kids, are afraid.
Oh, so afraid.
But as you get older, then it's like a big deal.
And then, you know, then your clock starts to tick because you haven't probably, I'm saying the 7 to 8 is the, you know, 6 is perfect, 7 to 8, you're almost losing them. 9, 10, if you have them to that, you're blessed because kids at school are talking, now he's not real, this is not real. And the joy, like we've had a lot of joy in our lives doing different things, but you've ever had just joy in your life just by seeing someone as much? You never do, you know? Yeah, sure, family members, but someone you don't even know, they just bring that feeling of the holidays, like, oh, Santa! And they look at you and they, with awe and joy. I get more leg tackles every year. Leg tackles. Last night I was doing something, all of a sudden I felt something on my leg. It was a little girl. She's like holding on to me for dear life. It's like, oh, it's so cute. Only problem with being Santa. Here's the only problem, John. Here's the problem I find myself in. I do Santa. So I'm at an event. I do Santa for a few hours, you know, say 4 to 6 hours. And then I change out of my Santa clothes and I have to go shopping or something. And I go into like a mall or I go to a restaurant or whatever. And I'm there and I see a little kid staring at me. And I go, oh, hi. And I wave. Well, I'm not Santa anymore. I'm Tim now. And I'm just a fat old guy with a white beard that's looking at people and I'm scaring kids. So I'm like, I got to remember not to do this. Don't look at, you know, when you see a kid, you just walk away because you're not Santa.
Or you should just wear your little Santa cap.
Yeah.
At the restaurant, so at least it disarms them a little bit if you're waving.
True, but a lot of times I don't want to. I'm done for the day. I'm like in my jacket or whatever.
You just tell these kids, hey, listen, Santa is now off the clock.
No, they don't understand off the clock.
Give the parents your card and say, I'd be more than happy to spend quality time with your children and in the proper channels.
But, you know, a lot of times they're just looking at me. They're not looking at me as Santa. They're just looking at me, so I'm scaring them.
Like, who's this? Who's this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, here's just a big guy walking in here. They're just looking at me like anybody else. If you walk anywhere else and a kid's looking at you, they don't think you're anything special. They're just like looking at you. So I got to remember, I'm not in a Santa suit.
I can understand that, but you've done an incredible job.
Oh, thank you, sir.
And maybe too late for people this holiday season to book you for a Zoom or a personal appearance or whatever. But why don't you just give out, you know, to the people who listen to this, I mean, give out, you know, where they can get a hold of you maybe for next season.
Sure. It's Jolly Santa Tim on Facebook and Instagram. And get a hold of me in, like, November if you want to do something.
Yeah.
You know, if you're around the L.A. area, or I love to come see you. I do parties. I do corporate events. I do a lot of things like that. But the thing I like doing one of the most is a Zoom. You know, I do it with grandparents, Zooming with their grandchildren anywhere in the world. I've done Japan. I've done, you know, a lot of the time military. Big with the military, for sure. Doing all over the world. Germany is another one I've done a lot of. And they're just fun. And I send you a little form to fill out on the kids. And the form is basically, you know, do you have an elf on the shelf? Do you have a dog? Do you have this? And it goes down. So I'm telling them, it's different from going to the mall where they goes, what's your name? I know their name. I know their likes. I know their dislikes. I know what I got them last year. I know what they left me last year. I know what they're doing good. I know what they're doing bad. So it's more of a personal experience when I do that. But since I'm doing so many personal appearances this year, I don't get to do as many Zooms as I'd like to. So if you want a Zoom, definitely next year, get in touch with me. Get in touch with me early, and I will get you on my list.
That's great. Hey, listen, I'm really happy for you. You've been really busy. And, you know, that was kind of a thing for me. I mean, I always loved Santa. I mean, I remember as a young kid going to Woolworth, which was a chain department store, very historic store.
Oh, yeah.
On Knickerbocker Avenue in the Bushwick section of Brooklyn. And I remember that was the first time I got to meet Santa and took a picture with him, and I still have that picture. So maybe I'll put it up for our patrons so they could take a look at it. But I did try the Santa thing once, and that was in the mid-70s. I think it could have been 75 or 76. And I had a niece who was born in 72, so she was like 4. Could have been like 78. She would have been 4 or 5. I had my two nephews. One was like 1.5, 2, and my other nephew might have been 3, 4. They were close together in age. So I decided that I was going to dress as Santa, and I didn't have the resources, I guess, to get a really good Santa suit. So I got a plastic one. It was like a plastic suit with a plastic hat, and the head that, you know, the beard that you kind of, the cheap looking beard you put on there.
Yep.
And I taped cotton balls on my eyebrows to give it the old authentic Santa feel. I didn't even put the mask on right. I think I put the opening for the mouth over my nose, and I put lipstick on the tip of my nose so it looked red and rosy. And so I'm in there, and it's fucking hot.
Yeah, they're hot.
In,
yeah.
In the apartment. Yeah, it's hot in the apartment, the house, rather, where my sister lived, my oldest sister, who's not with us any longer. But the heat was up, and then she goes up there to get the kids, and they come down. And I'm like, ho, 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 Merry Christmas. And it was so hot that the eyebrows that I had taped on my, the cotton balls I taped on my eyebrows fell off. And my niece was like, that's not Santa. That's Uncle Johnny. And it was kind of like they didn't know whether to laugh or cry, yeah. The little ones. But that was my one and only experience is playing Santa. You know, here we're talking wrestling. We're supposed to anyway. But
yeah,
I watched the Rudolph show every year. I mean, I love that show with Hermie the Dentist. And
the Claymation, yeah.
And I watched It's a Wonderful Life and I watch the Charlie Brown Christmas. It's just, and I watch the Macy's Parade every year on Thanksgiving.
Me too.
And March of the Wooden Soldiers. And
me too.
It's all time tested traditions.
It's so
that
funny
I can't,
that
at this age, even give up.
We talk about this stuff, and there's going to be people all around the country and all around the world that don't understand why we watch these things, and it's because back in the day in New York, we only had how many channels? We had 5. Is that correct, John? We had
2, 4, 7, 9, 11, 13.
And 13. 13 was the PBS channel.
2, 4, 7, 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11, and 13.
Okay. And I knew it was 9 and 11 that would show like March of the Wooden Soldiers, or they do
yes.
A Wonderful Life.
And still do.
And they still they still do. And the reason why they would do that a lot because they lost their copyright. You know, no one redeeded the copyright. That's why A Wonderful Life was played so much when we were younger, because it lost its copyright. And only a few years ago did they pick up the copyright again. Now NBC has it, so they only allowed to air it twice a year.
Yep.
Is that crazy?
Yep.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
So, yeah, why we watch these things, and I'm sure there are people in other parts of the country that go, oh, I didn't watch that, but I watched this, you know?
Yeah.
Because
well,
it was...
PIX, Channel 11 in New York, WPIX, still runs on Thanksgiving morning, the March of the Wooden Soldiers. And then directly after that is the annual Honeymooners Marathon.
Yeah, the Honeymooners Marathon. I bought March of the Wooden Soldiers on DVD so I can see it out here in L.A.
I love that movie.
Yeah, love it.
And also Miracle on 34th Street with Natalie Wood when she was just a little baby. I mean, that was such a great movie. And the Santa, that was a story about them taking this guy to court and they couldn't disprove that he wasn't really Santa Claus.
He won an Oscar for that, you know.
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Yeah. And Natalie Wood, I've heard some great stories from Natalie Wood about how she really thought he was Santa. He treated everyone so nice on set. She believed he was the original Santa Claus.
Yeah.
I know supposed to talk wrestling, but this is a holiday
show. Well, you know, this episode is kind of Christmassy because wrestling fans got something that they had wished for a very long time on this show, which was really almost a holiday show at the Garden. And that was... the ability to see Emil Máscaras for the very first time, and we'll be talking about that.
Yeah, the first time a masked wrestler wore a full whole mask. So let's get into the card right now. Madison Square Garden, Monday, December 18th, 1972. John, where'd you get the tickets? Where'd you sit?
For this show, I remember sitting not, you know, 6th, 7th row, the same location. I can't remember specifically where I got the tickets, Ticketron or the Garden box office. I don't know. I mean, but the seats were fairly good. it was around this time, which was in the middle of December, that I started to really needle my parents. Like, I want a movie camera for Christmas. I want a movie camera for Christmas. So that was my personal wish. And this particular show, I had my little Instamatic camera there. And I was I remember being disappointed because for some reason the flash wasn't working. And so any picture that I took of Mascaris's debut and some of the others that I really wanted to see there, and we'll get into that as we cover it, it was a lost night in regard to getting content back in 1972 for me.
You were even back then trying to get content. Do you remember the buildup for TV for this card?
Yeah, I do actually. Obviously, it was the return match with Morales going against Ray Stevens, but the buildup was really Mascaris. It was Mascaris, and it was so exciting to know that this guy that I wanted to see, because on Channel 41 and all the wrestling magazines, superstar, but also the question about the mask, and even with my buddy Frank Favalli, who I went to all these shows with, he was arguing, they're not going to let him wear the mask. I was like, he can't come here with that open mask. And it was just kind of a back and forth. He's not going to wear it. I'm like, he's got to wear it. They got to do something. And that's what I remember pre-show about just the conversations that were being had. But it was an exciting announcement about Mascaris coming to New York.
Now, so he didn't do any TV itself. Maybe they just announced it. He didn't do any matches on TV.
You know, I don't really recall, but he might have done TV in regard to, or maybe it was the second time he came to town. Because I don't really remember when he did his first TV taping in Philly. If it wasn't, it might have been in the mid-70s. This might have been just based on the weekly appearances that he made on Channel 41 from the Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles. I mean, that's how people knew him.
Okay. I was wondering
about
that. I
don't remember. I have to say I don't remember.
No worries. The card was, for the first time in a long time, this is not only a sellout, you broke gate records. The WWWF set a new gate record with 22,906. So Mascaris or some of the other things going to go on the card, people wanted to see it.
There were two reasons for this. And I have to say they were both based from the performers from L.A. coming in. Mascaris and also Great Goliath, who was a mainstay villain and a tag team partner at Black Gordman, who had made his debut the month before. But I think those two made it a sellout, because you got to understand that the fans, obviously watching the WWF, but in Spanish on Channel 41, the Olympic Auditorium show was always in Spanish. And those guys were just as big as stars as what was being pushed on Channel 47, which was the WWF. So combining those worlds, I feel that is the main reason why this did a record gate for that night in December of 1972.
Interesting. Okay, let's get into the card. Match number one, Joe Turco beat Black Jack Slade in 9 minutes, 10 seconds.
Nothing to say. Joe Turco, my beloved Joe Turco, my tag team partner, Joe. I mean, what can – and Black Jack Slade was – we have discussions around him on the past podcast. So not memorable. I don't even remember seeing it. Maybe I was getting popcorn.
It is what it is. It's an opening card match. Usually you put these things on. Back in the day, this is how they would do it. They wouldn't have all this fireworks and everything go off. They put a match on like this that would last 9 minutes, and people say, oh, the match is starting. We got to get in there. Grab your drinks. Go to the bathroom. Do what you got to do and rush in, because you don't want to miss anything. And that's why these opening matches are so long.
You knew that the matches were going to start usually around 8:25, because it's bell time is always at 8:30. And from the rafters, people started whistling. Everyone just started whistling. And you knew that, all right, now, and started, people started building and the whistling is starting. And then when you heard that bell ring and the lights go up to light up that ring, that was it. And everyone was like, here we go. It's time for another show at the Garden.
Match number two, Tony Garea beat Bull Pimenta in 10 minutes, 46 seconds.
His nickname was the Bull, but he went also as Vincente Pimenta, which was kind of a cool name. Typical job guy, enhancement talent or whatever. Garea, just that matinee idol, beating Pimenta, which was no big surprise. And the finisher that he used, which was always cool, there were two finishers. Either he'd drop kick you three times and get the 1-2-3, or he'd put you in an abdominal stretch. And I believe in this match with Vincente Pimenta, that he actually beat him with the abdominal stretch.
And Pimenta was also involved in handicap matches with Johnny Ross. He lost to Gorilla Monsoon. I wanted to bring up handicap matches because do they even do handicap matches anymore, or do they even use that term anymore?
No. I mean, they used to do them prominently back in the day. I mean, Pimenta in this match, obviously, the one you referred to was November 16th, 1970. And that's when he made his first Garden appearance when he teamed up with Johnny Rods against Gorilla Monsoon. But handicap matches, and I was in one, you know, me and Savannah Suser. But it was, if you wanted to get a heel over, you would put a handicap match in. And a lot of the big heels on one of the TV matches would be, even guys like Stan Stasiak would have a handicap match against two jobber guys. That's the way they looked unbeatable.
Yeah.
And Andre really always worked handicap matches against the enhancement guys for most of his TV appearances.
Match number three, the Great Goliath, there's your man, pinned Mario Soto in 7 minutes.
Yeah, they gave him the victory coming in. Great Goliath, certainly just excited to see him. This was his first Garden appearance. He was one half of that great tag team with Black Goldman. He also was in a 1985 wrestling movie called Grunt. Goldman and Goliath won the NWA World Tag Team titles in 1978 when they defeated the Steigers, Kurt and Carl. Just a great heel, great brawler, exciting to see. And Soto, I mean, he had an amazing run at the Garden. He had 47 MSG appearances. So when you're looking at these two guys, they were kind of equally matched when it comes to skills. But with Goliath coming in from L.A. off the TV, and they might have had ideas about long-term for him and Goldman coming in, but that never materialized. So obviously Goliath was going to get the win, and he got the win in just 7 minutes.
Match number four, Sonny King went to a 20-minute draw with Buddy Wolf.
Yeah, snoozer. Sonny King way down on the card. He was listed as a showboat Sonny King in most of the wrestling magazines. He had his run. He had his tag team title reign with Chief J. Strongbow. But he was on his way out, on his way down the card. And Buddy Wolf would just come in for, you know, he was kind of like a guy that they used against some of the featured attractions, as we'll find out. Because he fights Mascaris, and he is the opponent for Andre the Giant in 1973 for Andre's debut. But a good, as they say, you know, a good worker and a good hand, as they would say in the business these days. But it was a 20-minute draw, nothing to remember from that particular match.
I wanted to ask you about intermissions. When would they do an intermission at the Garden? Because I remember back in the day, you used to do intermissions at wrestling matches.
It was all staggered, different places. Sometimes they do an intermission after the heavyweight championship match. Sometimes they do an intermission when they announce the next show at the Garden to give fans maybe a little bit more time to run down and see if they can get a ticket or so. But it was never like at the same point of each show. It was always in different places on the show.
Got it. So it wouldn't be like after match number six, you'd have an intermission.
Or it could have been when the crowd was a little bit too frantic. If there was a match that the fans maybe were getting a little bit too amped up, and when that match completed, to give it time to cool off, they'd say, let's take a 20-minute intermission.
Interesting. And those are things you don't see anymore. There are no more intermissions because they're going for TV time.
Right.
Match number five is something, if anybody has this on video, I would love to see this. Gorilla Monsoon beat Chuck O'Connor in 6 minutes, 17 seconds. I would love to see this match because of who Chuck O'Connor turned into, Big John Studd, versus Gorilla Monsoon. I would love to see how he wrestled back in the day. I think it'd be amazing.
I agree. I mean, if there was any footage of that, I'd love to see it. And I was a month shy from having my 8mm camera there, Tim, so I couldn't help out by any stretch of the imagination. But anyway, Monsoon against O'Connor. O'Connor still not winning at the Garden, and he became such a prominent superstar years later and tag team champions with Killer Kowalski as the executioners. But yeah, I mean, for some reason, they just wouldn't give him the rub and give him a win. But he wasn't losing to a jabroni in this match either. I mean, it was Monsoon, and Monsoon, when he was in the ring, Monsoon wasn't going to get pinned by anyone, but he beat O'Connor pretty handily, probably I don't think it was a pin. It might have been a submission via bear hug.
We were talking earlier about watching the wrestling from Los Angeles. A lot of the wrestlers who came in, did you feel that these wrestlers who came in are getting a lot of applause at the time? Because I'm looking at the next match is El Olimpico, which is a great Mexican wrestler. How, you know, did you feel it like these Mexican wrestlers are getting more of a pop than like Gorilla Monsoon did or things like that, or about equal?
Not a guy like Olimpico.
Well, I mean, like some of the other guys. So if we say like the Great Goliath, do you hear the pop?
Yeah, well,
for the
he would get like oohs and ahs because it was almost like they were so like, this is really the guy from Los Angeles, and so I mean, they would get, well, he was a heel, so we get extra boos because he did play the heel. But there were those bigger responses when there was kind of an attraction coming in, you know, and for me, I was just personally, I was so excited just to see these guys that I'd just seen on TV, and never thought I'd be seeing LA guys coming into the Garden.
It was a different time. This is special. This is why you want to go to the matches, to see these guys. Match number 6, El Olimpico and Victor Rivera beat Dory Funk Sr. and Terry Funk in a 2 out of 3 falls, 2 falls to 1 match, 15 minutes, 3 seconds. This sounds unbelievable.
Yeah, it was unbelievable, especially the third fall of the match, which surprised everybody. But Rivera, they were giving a big push to. And the Funks were there now on a semi-regular basis. They started wrestling at the Garden in 1971, and it was always great to have them in town. And they were just true legends, even at that time, Dory Sr. especially, and Terry was really just getting started. But in this match, and Olimpico, one note about Olimpico, he wore the cutout mask. So even though Moskris is on the card, and this left a lot of speculation, even with my friend Frank and I, see, Olimpico's wearing a cutout mask. They're not going to let Moskris come in and wear his mask. So Olimpico had the cutout mask. He didn't have the full face mask. If he had the full face mask on, you would know for sure that Moskris was going to follow up later on in the show with his mask on. I don't think it was an intentional swerve by Vince McMahon Sr., but it brought discussion like, this sucks. Is Moskris going to come out with the full mask? But anyway, getting back to the match, fall number 1, Dory had Olimpico submit with his finisher, the famous finisher, the spinning toe hold. And in the second fall, the Funks were disqualified for double teaming and tossing Rivera over the top rope. And in fall number 3, this was a real shocker because Rivera pinned Dory Funk Sr. with a missile drop kick, and the referee gave an incredibly fast count of a 1-2-3. And it was sad. There was only a couple of more appearances from Dory Sr. at the Garden. One of those, or two of those, actually, I captured on film because he passed away of a massive heart attack in, I believe it was the middle to end of 73. So one of the last times we're going to get to see Dory Sr. But this was a shocker, especially with Rivera and Olimpico, who was really an enhancement guy, if you look at it, beating this legendary tag team of Dory Funk Sr. and Terry Funk.
All right, match number 6. This is the big one. The first masked wrestler to wear a full mask at Madison Square Garden. Yes or no? Mil Máscaras pinned the Spoiler in 7 minutes, 20 seconds. What happened, John?
Well, it was exciting to say the least. I mean, the place erupted when he came out. Máscaras would come out because I always loved his white mask with the black accentuating marks on it with the M in the middle, and that was kind of his mainstay mask. He comes out with another mask on, but when he would get introduced and the place is going wild, he'd rip that first mask off, and there's the classic Máscaras mask. And everyone was just like so excited. I mean, he almost got a hero's welcome at the Garden, and him coming in to face the Spoiler, it was amazing. It really was one of the highlights of my entire fandom, being able to see this guy that I've only adored watching on TV and reading in the magazines, you know, sitting not too far from him at ringside. Máscaras, also known as his real name, Aaron Rodriguez, he debuted July 20th, 1963. He retired, had a long, long career, 2019. He made his international wrestling debut in 1968 from Mexico, and he went to the Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles and immediately caught on with the fans over there, became a superstar. And other highlights of his career, in 1974, Mill was the champion of the short-lived IWA, International Wrestling Association, that was based in New York City. And it's really kind of interesting is that here he is, McMahon is bringing him in for some shots at the Garden. Who knows what the long-term plan was? And then he gets contacted by Pedro Martinez, Eddie Einhorn, and they were running the IWA, and they made him the champion because they thought that they were going to go up again. And they tried the first national promotion, the IWA. So Moskris is their champion. It was kind of copycatting what McMahon did, where you're going to be pushing an ethnic champion as your champion, especially in the Northeast. But Moskris also had that fan following everywhere just based on the wrestling magazines and some of the towns that were syndicating the Los Angeles Olympic Auditorium stuff. So he came in as a superstar. They can never make headway in the New York market. They couldn't get into the buildings that they wanted to get in because of blocks from Vince McMahon. So they held their first major show in New York area at the really rundown Roosevelt Stadium in 1975. Actually, I was at that show when he fought Ivan Koloff there in the pouring rain. It was just it was exciting, but they couldn't get any traction because they couldn't get into the major arenas. And this was the first time that promoters from around the country all kind of got together and blackballed them from these arenas. When you have McMahon working with the NWA and the AWA and the other territories to box them out because they wanted to go national. And ironically, you know, this is what Vince McMahon Jr. did anyway. He went national and he didn't give a shit what anyone else thought. But Moskris was also a big movie star. I mean, he starred in 20 movies in Mexico. He was someone that was just revered. He definitely could have been the main reason that show was sold out. Just like the ladies' matches, which were several months early when Moolah debuted as the first women's match, this was historically significant as the very first masked wrestler, fully masked wrestler, to be at Madison Square Garden. Now, in doing the research for this, and I really found it really interesting, Richie Garcia, of course, always sends us some really good notes about this, and he talked about this anti-mask law that was passed in New York City in 1845, which kind of prohibited anyone from wearing masks. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back, and I am actually going to read the actual law that was passed at that time.
Oh.
So let me check it out right here.
Gather around, children.
Gather around. This is a Christmas story, ho, 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 about masked wrestlers being barred, and all masked people, actually. The New York Penal Law 240.35, number 4, was the anti-mask law passed in New York City in 1845. The intent was to discourage armed uprisings by tenant farmers in the Hudson Valley who were using disguises to attack law enforcement officers. So the law reads, being masked or any manner disguised by unusual or unnatural attire or facial alteration remains or congregates in a public place with other people so masked or disguised, or knowingly permits or aids persons so masked or disguised to congregate in a public place, except that contact is not unlawful when it occurs in connection with a masquerade party or like entertainment event in which such entertainment is held in a city which has promulgated regulations in connection with such affairs. Permission is first obtained from the police or appropriate authorities. So I guess you had to get permission to wear a mask. Whether this was the reason that masked wrestlers could not appear at the Garden is an interesting topic to discuss. But what brought Moskris in, and he would certainly not come to New York unless he was able to wear that full mask. Moskris, unlike others like Olympico and the Russians when they come in, and he refused to wrestle without the mask. He told McMahon, I will not wrestle at the Garden unless I can wear my mask. And he was so popular, McMahon lobbied for a change in the law. And no doubt The money found its way into the state officers or the state coffers through the State Athletic Commission. So there was a deal that was made or cut with the New York State Athletic Commission, who might have got and used lobbying to change the law. And it was changed, and it granted the permission for Moskowitz to come in and wear that mask. So there was a lot of political wrangling for Moskowitz to be approved to come into the Garden. And then, of course, you know, he stabs McMahon in the back like a year later, you know, and goes with the IWA as their champion.
So a couple of things I want to ask you about this. First of all, we talked about like the spoiler, L'Olimpico, the Rugged Russians. After this card, were they able to come back and wear their masks?
The others?
Yes.
For whatever reason, L'Olimpico never wore the mask, the full mask. He always opted now for that cutout. But other masked wrestlers, and I'm trying to think of who else I would remember from that time
period. Like the spoiler, did he come back when he came
back?
Well,
no,
after
he
this?
Didn't wear his mask either. And this might have been his, I don't know if this was his last appearance or not, but no, he didn't. He didn't. Only Moskowitz was the guy, I guess, maybe for several years. Until the executioners, because the executioners wore the black mask.
Which was a great gimmick, by the way.
And that was in 75.
Yeah, that was a great gimmick. That was a great gimmick. I love the executioner gimmick. I was so scared of them. I love them.
Even though you knew who, and most people knew who they were, Kowalski's body was always like identifiable. Yeah. And Chuck O'Connor, I mean, everyone knew it was them.
I didn't know. You were informed. I was a kid. I didn't remember any of that stuff. But
And you know, there was rumors about that anyway, why they wore the mask.
Really?
Because at that time, Kowalski was getting hair implants.
Oh, interesting. I do remember watching on TV when the masked superstar came in, and I think it was Gorilla Monsoon. Whoever's doing the commentary, it was a great line they said. They said, why does he wear a mask? You should open the mask. He said, well, he's probably, you know, a professional football player or a professional this, and he doesn't want anybody else knowing he's making money on the side being a wrestler. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a great angle. Getting back one last time from Mil Máscaras, I went and met him a few years ago. He was actually doing a signing here in Los Angeles, and I went and I met him. I was the only person online of non-ethnicity to see him, and he noticed that when I saw him, and he's like, oh, hi, and I said, I used to watch you on, you know, in the WWF back in the day when I was a kid, and he just started talking to me about it. He was like, oh, really? Oh, that's very interesting. Oh, that I wasn't there very long, you know? It was just huge to meet him, because I was like, that became, when I saw him wrestle, I became a fan of his so much, and I never got to see him in person like you did. But meeting him in person was, you know, totally worth the wait.
Well,
it was really
I booked
cool.
him that one time in Phoenix. I mean, he was in my main event, and my very last show that I ever promoted as a wrestling promoter at the Arizona State Fair in Phoenix, and that was in 1996, and I put him in my main event. You know, the story's in my book, but it left a very bad distaste for me with Mil Máscaras. And I still revere him to this day for what he did in his career, but it was one of the most bizarre interactions that I ever had with a wrestler. Well, first of all, he shows up, and he shows up kind of late, and he gives me his plane ticket, which I had bought him a plane ticket, and he goes, Drone, I upgrade myself to first class, so I need to be reimbursed. And I'm like, but I paid for your ticket. I can't give you, you know, first class ticket. I mean, we didn't work that out in our contract or whatever. No, I want reimbursement from this. And that was kind of like, I thought it was pretty shitty.
Yeah.
All right. So, and he, you know, he did okay. It was a show that I lost a shitload of money on. It was not a good, it was kind of like a revenue share out there. And it just didn't work out. And it kind of got me out. I was like, I'm done, you know, with this whole thing. But anyway, he kept calling me after the show had been done, and I'm back in, you know, New York, and he's calling me like, John, Mil Máscaras, I want the reimbursement for the first class ticket. I'm like, Mil, I'm not paying you this. And it was so ironic that when I finally got disgusted and got out of the wrestling business, okay, you know, it's a year later, and I'm in my apartment, and my mom stayed with me on Long Island. It's like a year later after this show, the phone rings, and I'm out of wrestling. I'm working in country radio on Long Island now.
Yeah.
I'm doing really well. And the phone rings, and my mother answers the phone, and she listens, and she gives me the phone. She goes, Johnny, there's a Mr. Máscaras on the phone. I was like, hello, John, Mil Máscaras. I was like, oh, hey, Mill, how are you? What is going on with this plane ticket? I was like, listen, Mill, Moskris, I'm out of the fucking wrestling business, and I've been out of the wrestling business now for almost a year. And I told you when we did the deal, I wasn't paying for a first-class ticket, and I'm certainly not going to pay for one now.
Yeah.
And I hung up on him.
You know, John, I heard stories about how difficult he was to work with in the ring. I didn't know how difficult
he was. No
jobs. No jobs. Even when he was in his 70s or whatever. When you were,
no job.
No job. No job. Well.
I mean, look what he did. I mean, he was very selfish in the ring. He was one of the best performers ever on the Mexican side, the Lucha Libre side. He was an attraction. He was beloved. He was in great physical condition. He had that it factor, that charisma. You know, the man of a thousand masks and a hold to match everyone was kind of his MO.
Yeah, yeah.
And I loved the guy. I mean, he was one of my all-time favorites and still is, to you know, when it comes to that. And I never forget even buying, there was these special books from Japan, and this was a thick, all-Mil Máscaras book. I got it through, actually, Dr. Mike Leno years ago in Los Angeles. He had found one, and I still revere the guy. I still love the guy as a performer and what he meant to the business all those years ago. But the horror stories that you hear from people who were in the ring with him, he was not cooperative, especially towards the latter part. I mean, Cactus Jack has an infamous story about the Clash of the Champions show, the match he had with Mil Máscaras. And the only reason that Cactus said that people would remember that match is because Cactus took this incredible bump off the ring apron on the cement and splattered on the floor. That was the only way he felt people were going to remember, because Máscaras wouldn't give him anything in the match.
Wow.
So, yeah, anyway, the good and bad of Mil Máscaras, Aaron Rodriguez, legend. But this was his first appearance in New York. He wore the mask. He beat the Spoiler pretty handily, 7 minutes, 20 seconds. He'd have these great crossbody moves where he would leap in the air and he'd kind of hit the guy in the chest as he's running the ropes. And then he goes up on the top rope and he delivers that really, really good crossbody from the top with great elevation. And 1, 2, 3, it's over, and the crowd goes wild.
Yeah, it was a great move. And as a photographer, I always wondered if you knew where he was going to go, because some photographers get that great shot, you know, of the opponent's
yes.
back and him in the air.
Yeah, I have so many great shots of Máscaras that I shot, even when the IWA appeared in Jersey for that debut show against Ivan Koloff. These photos almost look like artwork. I mean, they were black and white, and a lot of them on my social media. But just the way the lighting was, and these shots are like classic black and white. They look like paintings in a way. I shot so many pictures of Máscaras. I mean, I just loved the guy until I, you know, promoted a match with him.
And then you didn't.
Other than that, like I said, in my top 10 of all time, is Máscaras is going to be on that list.
He's on both top 10s. Top 10 to work with and top 10 not to work with.
Yeah. An asshole, but he was great.
Yeah. Let's go to match number 7.
Come on, it's Christmas time, Tim.
Let's go to match number 7, Johnny. WWF Heavyweight Champion Pedro Morales beat Ray Stevens in 14 minutes, 10 seconds in the return match.
Yeah, it was, you know, that first match was brawly and bloody and exciting. This one, especially because it was following Máscaras, you know, too. So, I mean, it could have took a little steam out of the crowd, but Morales still beloved. It was 14 minutes, 10 seconds, as you said. Morales pinning Stevens with a sunset flip after Stevens thought he had won with a Boston Crab. So Stevens has Morales in the Boston Crab. Morales is moving around trying to get out of it. And then, you know, Morales reaches and puts his hand on the rope, and the referee taps Stevens on the back, like, all right, I won. I'm the champion. Raises his arms up. Morales gets behind him, throws him into the ropes, turns him around in the sunset flip, pins him 1, 2, 3, and that was the end of it.
That's awesome. It's a nice way to end the match. I kind of like that.
It was a little different. It was a little tricky.
A little tricky
on Morales' part, but the fans went home very happy.
Oh, well, speaking of fans going home happy, how would you rate this show, John?
I would say big thumbs up.
I couldn't agree more.
Because of Máscaras, because of the Great Goliath.
Those are two. I would go even with the Gorilla Monsoon, be Chuck O'Connor, but the Funks being in a tag team.
The Funks,
you know, and Ray Stevens and Morales.
Yeah, but for me personally, it was the fact that I'm seeing these people from Channel 41 from Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles. That was my favorite wrestling. I liked that TV show even more than what WWF was doing, and getting to see Mil Máscaras in person and the Great Goliath. You were only anticipating more of that type of stuff in 1973.
You know what's so great about it also, because I watch wrestling from Japan at times. If you can watch a match and not understand the commentating and still enjoy it, that's a great match.
Yes. So anyway, I give it a thumbs up, man.
Fantastic. Hey, John and I want to thank again all our Patreons, www.patreon.com/John Arizzi. Join the family. Join the fun. What are you adding to Patreon recently, John? What have you been putting up there?
Well, we actually took a little bit of a break because of the holidays, but we're putting more content up there now that we're coming back. We did a best of 1992, the top stories of 1992. But we have, more classic vintage audio from WWF in 1975 and 77 up there now. Probably going to do a photo set of Mil Máscaras just based off of this episode. And I'll pick some of those shots that we're talking about, and I'll give the fans or the patrons access to a bunch of Máscaras pictures in collaboration with this episode.
Nice.
So I'll make sure I do that when we do that content. But we're also now getting into 73, and 73 is a pivotal year. That's when I get the 8mm camera. That's when my pictures start getting better. That's when I'm taking this a little bit more seriously. I think we have there, and for the regular listeners of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast, you're going to get a lot of stuff. 1993, now this is 73 that we talk about, but 1993 was such a huge year in my career and in pro wrestling, because we start the year off. First episode, we kind of talked about what was going to be happening. Then we get Jesse the Body Ventura on for a big interview. Paulie Dangerously gets fired from WCW, and then we cover Andre the Giant's death on the last week of January, which was in 1993. Andre died, and I was listening to the show that I did when I found out about it. Got on the phone, Frenchie Bernard, who he and his wife Jackie were the caretakers of Andre's farm and lived with Andre on the farm in North Carolina. So I got Frenchie on to talk about, was it true? How did he, I didn't keep the guy on very long, but he was able to confirm that Andre had indeed passed away. And this was on my Pro Wrestling Spotlight radio show, which people will be hearing at the end of January 2023, 30 years ago. And I have booked through a guy named Chris Owens, who's probably the most foremost Andre the Giant historian out there. He got a hold of Jackie. Frenchie Bernard is now passed away as well. But Jackie, Frenchie's wife, is still alive and still in North Carolina, and she's going to do the podcast. She's going to come on and reminisce about Andre.
Wow.
So that's a big one.
That is big.
And, we go back on WEVD, which is a big move for me on back 30 years ago. And then our first show on WEVD, we have to cover the unfortunate suicide of Kerry Von Erich. And I had gotten on the phone with the police department in Texas and got that sound on the radio episode of the sergeant giving the detailed report, some of it pretty graphic, that was on the Pro Wrestling Spotlight. And then we have Ultimate Warrior, who leaves the WWF, and he comes on the radio show. So we have an amazing, and then Conan comes on shortly thereafter, because that's when I put together, that's our first meeting with Conan, Antonio Pena, Ron Scholar, myself, Carol Kirkendall, Daryl, who managed Salt and Pepper, and we were putting together the AAA deal to bring them into the United States in August of 1993. So if you haven't listened to the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast, it's going to be amazing what you're going to hear as we go back 30 years. And on this show, in our next episode, it's the first time I shoot movies at Madison Square Garden for that Lonnie Main versus Pedro Morales main event, the Vachon brothers, and others. So we got some really good shit happening, not just on Patreon, but if you continue to listen to this show month after month and the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast, wherever you get your favorite podcast, check it out. We got a lot of great shit happening for next year.
Absolutely. Patreon.com/John Rizzi is where you get be part of the community, join the fun, and also get some great stuff. I can't wait to see some of these pictures of Mil Máscaras that you're not putting watermarks on these things, John. You're giving them to people who are Patreons.
Yes, that's the good thing about what I put up on the Patreon account is like these are unwatermarked photos.
Fantastic. Our next garden show, January 15th, 1973. First of the show of the year, headlining Lonnie Moondog Maine versus Pedro Morales for the title. Wait, he's from, was it Crabtree, Oregon?
Yeah.
I was thinking.
Crabtree, Oregon.
John, Richie, he kills me. Once again, we want to thank, shout out to Scott Teal and Crowbar Press.
Yeah, absolutely. Wrestling in the Garden is the book. It's our Bible. And that is on Crowbar Press. You can get a copy of it by going to his website, which is basically crowbarpress.com. And all of these little tidbits, artifacts, research, all of the garden shows for all of these decades are in this book. We couldn't do it without this masterpiece, Wrestling in the Garden. From Crowbar Press.
It's pretty amazing. And this is our final show of 2022, John. It's been a pleasure. I can't wait to 2023 to go off another 50 years of wrestling at the Garden with you. And I want to thank all our fans out there for sending us well wishes and wish you the best. And we want to wish everyone out there a happy and healthy holiday season.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays. For John Arizzi and Rich Garcia, I'm Tim Poutre. We'll see you next time.